Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Podnuts Pro. Ladies and gentlemen, I am your host, Marvin B., and yes, I am recording from Fort Lauderdale, Florida. And folks, I'm going to do something I normally don't do. I'm going to reference today's date of September 17th, 2018. And the reason I want to do that is I want to make a quick reference to Hurricane Florence. This is the first recording that I've done after the hurricane has made landfall. As many of you know, I pre-record a lot of my shows, and I have no idea when they're going to be released. The show that I'm actually doing tonight partly was recorded back in August, but it's being released tonight, so I wanted to just simply make a reference to the victims of Hurricane Florence. Want to send out my best wishes for everyone there, wish them the best, hope that it doesn't get any worse, although we know that there's still a lot to come. Many of you know, living here in Florida, we are used to dealing with hurricanes on a regular basis. North Carolina, even though it's on the coast, it doesn't happen as much for them as usual. Matt Rainey can attest to that, being in Louisiana, having to prepare a lot, but a lot of these people up in North Carolina don't have to prepare as often, and they certainly don't have to prepare for what's coming now and the threat of flooding as rivers still rise, even though the storm has passed. We certainly don't have to deal with something like that. So just wanted to make a special mention to that. If you can give, give. I had a couple of clients with branch offices up in Carolina. They are doing well. We prepared them as best as we could, and they are doing well. Our friends at Calyptics have some offices up in the Carolinas. As far as I know, they are doing well. So reach out to people that you know and give help where you can. All right. So what I want to do is I want to go back and release a show that I actually recorded before heading up to Chicago. This is what I thought was going to be a full series of security shows. Right now, it's just a series of one, but we shall see what happens. This was inspired by a lady that I met at a conference here in Fort Lauderdale, Teresa Payton. And I'm sure you've heard me talk about her. I've mentioned that I was going to do this show a couple of times. Teresa Payton is the first female White House Chief Information Officer, and obviously that is a big deal. She is also the CEO and founder of a company called Fortalice Solutions. She is co-founder of a site called Dark Cubed, which is a cyber product company, and then she has also served as head of intelligence on the CBS show Hunted. So Teresa was down here at a conference. She was the keynote speaker. And even though she came with a lot of preparation, a lot of handouts, we never got to discuss any of that. Her keynote speech basically ended up with her answering question after question after question about her time in the White House and what she sees as some of the personal tips that she could recommend for protecting oneself. And we never actually got to discuss what she was there to talk about, which was tips for small business and things that we could do as techs to help our businesses protect themselves against the threats of cybersecurity out there. Big thing at the time, ransomware. Of course, it's still big, but there's a couple of nice handouts specifically referencing ransomware. So Teresa is, she's pretty famous, she's pretty busy. And she was actually just on a Fox News show where she was giving tips on digital preparedness during Hurricane Florence. So if you can imagine, I really can't get her to be on a show like Podnuts Pro, but I was able to do almost as good, where we got a gentleman from Fortalice who is the Cyber Risk and Compliance Director at FortiLife Solutions, Jefferson Pike. So I was able to get him. He basically was able to help us go through some of the handouts that Teresa had, give his story and perception on a lot of the cyber risks that are out there. So we are going to be talking to Jefferson here in just a little bit. Turns out pretty good guest. I have no qualms in having Jefferson back if we never get Teresa, but we'll see. I also want to, let me go back and I'm going to read a couple of emails that also came in before my trip to Chicago. And one of the emails, let's see, this is an email from Ed, who is referencing a cable tester that I referenced back in show number 169, the triplet LV Pro. And that came up as a discussion, I don't remember where. I know I was sent a link by, I think it was Sean Scott. I don't know. I did pretty good with referencing the show number, so I'm going to leave it at that. And we actually talked about that. It looked like a pretty good tester for me. We actually were referencing the LV Pro 30 model, which was the full kit, and looked like a very reasonable price tester. And I got a couple of people that said they had it and used it and liked it. But I also wanted to read this because Ed had a different take. He writes, "Marvin, I had this tester and was very disappointed. I decided to keep it against my better judgment," and in parentheses he writes, "I'm a former Fluke test owner, but I didn't really use it very much as I didn't like it. It was extremely limited for its size and weight. The build quality of the triplet is cheap, and the screen is even cheaper. The device doesn't tell you any network information. It only shows wire map and distance, layer 1. It also displays if it detects PoE. Not PoE plus. Most of the other tests it can perform are not network related, i.e. coax, speaker, analog phone. I would not recommend this device to a network tech, as there are other testers out there that do a lot better job at testing network cables. Even at a relatively low price, I consider it expensive, as you will soon stop carrying it and using it due to the limitations I described above. Unfortunately/fortunately for me, it was stolen when my company truck was broken into. I was reimbursed by my insurance company for its costs, but I never replaced it. I opted for a LAN Explorer Pro at 10 times the price, but now I'm actually using the tool that I spent my hard-earned money on. Just my 2 cents, Ed." So, Ed, I want to thank you publicly here for that email. I did respond back to Ed thanking him for the review. So I do want to also reference that while I've heard of the LAN Explorer Pro, I have actually never seen it or used it myself. So that is another perspective on the, what did we test? The LV Pro from Triplet. And I got an email from Chris, and Chris was sending information about a Fluke toner set to a customer today, and I remembered you talking about a Fluke unit that you use for network discovery / diagnosis, etc. I can go back and check the podcast, but I thought it might be quicker to check with you if you had the model handy. I know it's a little pricey, but I think it would be worth it based on your description of what it can do. And there's more to that email, but I just want to address that portion there. And of course, I wrote him back, and I believe that he was referencing my Fluke / NetScout OneTouch AT, which is pretty much the one I carry with me everywhere. It's the network assistant. It does everything from very basic cable testing to network discovery, network testing, performance testing, Wi-Fi testing, fiber testing. It does a lot of stuff. So that's the one I told him that I usually recommend the most. While there are the other ones that I have, the Link Sprinter, the Link Runner AT, the AirCheck, the OneTouch AT is the one that I use the most. And on that note, I also want to say that very, very soon, I will be doing a show with NetScout. And I think it might be more than one show, but I can obviously guarantee at least one show. And one of the things that we will be discussing is, and if many of you have checked your emails, if you get emails from NetScout, or you've heard, as of September 14th, NetScout, the handheld network test unit, has been acquired by a company named Stone Calibur. So they've made the announcement. There will be changes coming. They didn't announce what those changes were in terms of name, etc. But I am going to be interviewing somebody high up in the hierarchy at NetScout, and that will be one of the things that we discuss. We're also going to be talking about the entire line of handheld testers and getting you guys some really good information to talk about these tools. Somebody that's not me, somebody inside the company that can provide us more insight and give us a lot more information. So that is going to be coming really, really soon. All right. So I think that is going to do it for our introduction and housekeeping. I want to go ahead and take a quick break, and then I will be right back with Jefferson Pike from Fortalice to talk about security tips for small business. All right, ladies and gentlemen, we are back and we are at the interview portion of our show. And as I mentioned earlier, I am joined by Jefferson Pike, who is the Director of Risk and Compliance at Fortalice Solutions. Jefferson, how are you?
Doing great today. Thank you. How about yourself?
I'm doing pretty good outside of a little rain in Florida, which can't believe that's happening. So Jefferson, let me just give a little bit of background on you. I had already mentioned at the beginning of the show that I got to you because Teresa Payton was a speaker at one of the conferences that I attended, the ASCII show, and I had wanted to get her to come on the podcast, and we all know that she is way too busy to That's do right. a lot of that stuff. But you're working there for Fortalice. You have had a nice little career in security. You actually worked Time Warner Cable at their command center, did the cybersecurity risk analysis at Spectrum. You were the IT senior lead auditor at Wells Fargo. What exactly was that?
Well, it's interesting. Wells Fargo has a huge cybersecurity program and a very good cybersecurity program and an even larger internal audit department. And one portion of the department is dedicated just to working with your cybersecurity side and kind of making sure that things are good to go from the regulator standpoint, from Federal Reserve and OCC and all of these big financial regulators. They have a lot of demands that you had to make sure that the cybersecurity posture and the maturity was in good shape.
Okay. All right. So one of the reasons that I wanted to get Teresa on was because we had a few outlines from her on how IT professionals like us could help our businesses stay more secure. Right. But as it seems that normally happens at her presentations, we never got to the presentation. People were too busy asking questions about, what type of security events happen at the White House, or, right. what do you do for personal security? So I wanted to get somebody on to help with the business side, because a lot of us as techs, we know the things to do for our password security and things like that. But one of our biggest downfalls is convincing our customers that they need to do security. And right. so I guess let me start with just simply asking you, because I know that I can spout off some stuff, but what do you think, or what do you guys see as some of the biggest threats to small business right now?
That's a good question. And probably the biggest threat right now will be ransomware attacks. Ransomware attacks are huge, and small businesses are the perfect target for ransomware simply because they don't normally have the defenses that a large enterprise would have, and they are more often than not wanting to get back online quickly. And so the easiest way to do that at first sight, your first impression would be you would think pay the ransom and get back online, although in real life, that's not how it works at all. But for someone, if you're not familiar with how these attacks occur, they may think what they need to do is just pay a fee and get back online. That's rarely the outcome that the results.
So one of the biggest problems that I see before even dealing with the ransomware itself is letting them know that they need to do security beforehand. They need to have a, you know, commercial grade firewall appliance. They need to have monitored antivirus and malware stuff. They need user training on how to deal with suspicious emails and stuff. So from somebody like me, I know that the battle is always trying to get them to say, you need this. Their response is, well, nobody's going to target me. We're too small. Or what do I have that they're going to want? So
exactly.
How do you guys advise? Now, I know you guys deal with, you know, much larger corporations and things like that, but you've got to be running against some of the same.
Absolutely. We are. And actually, our clients are more of the small to medium-sized businesses in the first place. We don't want to work with the large enterprises simply because they already have their own, ideally, hopefully, their own cybersecurity team in place. And they're working with pretty large resources. The small to medium-sized business doesn't really have that structure in place, typically. And you're right. They don't think the attack will happen to them. And many times, they already have adversaries in their network, and they don't even realize it. Not only are they suspect to, or they can be prey to ransomware attacks, they may be being leveraged for an attack against somebody else. A business many times is just a doorway to another business.
Okay.
In fact, many people didn't hear about Fazio Mechanical Services. You would never know who they were, ideally, but you probably heard of Target and the Target breach that happened as a result of that.
Right.
In that case, this HVAC contractor was just leveraged to gain access to a much bigger environment, which is Target. And we see that happen a lot, where these third-party vendors are actually being infiltrated and used to infiltrate other businesses for gaining real data, not necessarily ransomware attacks, although that can happen too, but just to actually get the data from a larger company. So small businesses either can fall prey to ransomware attacks, or it's being used as a doorway to another business.
Okay. So in that sense, so that company was, a vendor of Target's?
Yes. And vendors are great targets because many times, just like other small businesses, they don't have the cyber resources in place or don't think anybody would want anything from them. So they're not a threat or don't consider threats. And they're actually being used as a doorway to somebody else.
So any details that we can get from that in terms of how that was done? Was it something where it was a botnet that just got in, or was it one of those email mining type deals? Or
the biggest attack vector right now, and the easiest one, and we see this all the time when we do penetration tests and red team attacks on clients, is phishing, you know, spear phishing, where you'll have a targeted email come in and it will look totally legit to someone who's not been educated. If an employee thinks it's actually coming from an address that looks legitimate, and they'll click on a link and not think twice about it. And those attacks work, and that's why they're used, because they're effective. Even if you send an email out to 100 people, 70 people may say they'll just ignore it or know it's phishing and delete it. There will always be a few that will click on that link. And if they click on it, that can invite malware into their network that will then set up a command and control scheme and actually get the adversary into their network that way. So as simple as phishing sounds, it works. And it's those simple attacks that actually can ruin the day.
So I know that there are a lot of companies out there that are touting, you know, DNS filtering or cloud layered protection so that stuff doesn't make it into the customer's email box. We have, you know, the web filtering, we have the email filtering, but for some reason, this stuff seems to always get through.
Right. Right. And you know, cybersecurity, from a business perspective also, it's not sexy in the sense that it doesn't make money. Nobody thinks of cybersecurity as being a profit center for that business unless they're a vendor trying to sell a product. And there are a lot of good products out there, but cybersecurity takes an investment. It's a cost center. And unfortunately, in this day and age, you have to spend money to actually try to defend yourself, but it doesn't have to be expensive. And there are actually steps to follow where you can make your network pretty well protected without spending a lot of money at that stage. And for instance, there's one resource called the Center for Internet Security, and they have the CIS controls. They're also known as the CIS Top 20 or the SANS Top 20 controls. And this is a framework of recommendations that can be used for any company or any organization. But even of those 20, the first five are what are known as real keys to cyber hygiene. And if you don't have the first foundational steps in place, then it makes no sense to go forward and worry about, you know, these advanced filters or firewalls or applications you spend more money on. If you have these basic steps in place, and they're simple, like knowing what your hardware assets are, making sure that only step number one is having inventory and control of your hardware assets, making sure that you don't have old hardware assets still on the system turned on and as part of your network because you replaced them several years ago but forgot to turn them off. And we actually have seen that happen before with the company, and they still had these systems on the network. The number two would be just having inventory and control of software assets and making sure that you only have software that's approved on your network that has gone through your system, and you actually have an approval process. You know what you have that you're using.
Right.
Those are just simple. Also, having a continuous vulnerability management program in place, which doesn't take a lot of work. It takes work, but doesn't take money. You can actually make sure that your patching is up to date. And it's that lack of patching that more often than not is what creates these cases where bad guys will come in the network and exploit a vulnerability, as I'm sure you've seen before.
Right.
It's something that could have been prevented. It's not some new gimmicks being used. It's maybe an exploit that's been out there for over a year. It could have been prevented. And number four is just administrative privileges, making sure that you're controlling the use of administrative privileges. We've seen companies before where everybody had admin privileges because they're an up-and-coming company, and they figured, well, everybody should have admin privileges to do what they need to because they don't want to stop the flow of business. And that sounds good from one standpoint, but not from a security standpoint. You want to have as few as possible have admin privileges to get the job done and to make sure that your network's up and running, but you don't want everybody to have those privileges.
Right.
And some companies actually do that. And the fifth one is just having a secure configuration for your systems, for your mobile devices, or laptops, and workstations, and servers, where there should be a golden image configuration for those systems. And many companies and organizations don't have that, or they may have had that at one point, and then as they add more hardware, they have multiple configurations out there, and they may have open ports and services on their systems that they don't even realize. So they need to have a program in place, just making sure that that's set up.
Right.
And so before even going to anything else like boundary defense, data protection, those first five elements need to be in place.
Okay.
And it was interesting. I was at a presentation where one of the editors of the CIS controls was speaking, and it was the same day where the 12 Russians were indicted for the breach that happened, and all the DNC information was exfiltrated. And he mentioned that as he looked at all the processes and the techniques that were used to exfiltrate all that data, he mentioned that those first five principles were in place. Those CIS controls had been followed thoroughly. That breach never would have happened, and we wouldn't be having this discussion that we've been having in the news for over a year, because that could have been prevented and with simple defenses, not anything overly intricate.
Right.
So that applies on national level, but also on the small business level as well.
So I was going to mention, when you brought up admin privileges, because just yesterday I had to deal with a client of mine where they're not my direct client in the sense that I manage everything from them every day. They actually have an on-site tech that is supposed to take care of stuff. And right. one of the battles that I've had with that tech is anytime that he goes and installs something or sets up a new user, he immediately makes the user an admin and then does not take those rights away. And between that and the fact that anybody that is a partner, it's a law firm. Mm-hmm. So anybody with the title partner thinks that they should be able to do whatever they want with their computer.
You know,
my name's on the door. I sign the checks. And usually those are the people that I would want least
right.
to be the admin. And so that is a battle that, I mean, we'll probably keep fighting for quite some time. Now, do you have situations where you can look and advise somebody in the eye that is a partner or a key figure and say, look, you can't have those. It needs to be limited. How do you battle something like that?
That's a tough question, and that's a tough battle to fight. Thankfully, we have the news and the media really helping us do that job for us. If we can just show them examples of similar businesses where they have similar situation, but yet they've been exposed and they've lost millions of dollars, even whether through a business email compromise or they've been breached, or we can show that, hey, here's what happened in this incident. You don't want that to happen to you, and we can help stop that. Here's how. So thankfully, really, the news is doing a great job. Not using just fear, uncertainty, and doubt as motivators, but fear is a big motivator right now. And just showing these executives, I understand they're, these are big egos we deal with a lot of times. Right, and I think they should have access to everything. We try to gently explain that they don't want to be like example A over here, and we can help prevent that while there's still time.
Yeah, it's always nice when I can point to a target and say, look, they're bigger than you, and look what happened right. to them. So,
right.
So in a sense, so we've got two things, and I was going to try to go in a particular order, but I wanted to stay on the corporate side. And one of the things that I was trying to do in a security series is talk about breaches from within. And all of a sudden shadow IT has come up as the key phrase of what to protect against. And while most people would deny that shadow IT exists, mainly it's because they're not the ones, trying to protect against it. But is employee sabotage real or imagined?
It is real, but it's not necessarily always intentional.
Right.
Sabotage, yes, it does happen. Not as much as we think. More often than not, it's the unintentional. It's actually about a 50-50 ratio we're seeing, but you don't always see it in the news anymore because there are bigger issues and cyber incidents that kind of take the headlines now. But sabotage is real. And for instance, Tesla just recently, depending on who you talk to, there are different articles, but they're blaming a lot of their losses recently on employee sabotage.
Right.
And that employee, according to them, actually exfiltrated a large amount of proprietary data from their company. And then, again, according to them, set up three other workstations, employee workstations on the network that even after he was fired, it was still sending information out and making it look like these other employees were associated with the data theft. However, he's now countersued and saying he's being framed and none of that happened. So it will be interesting to see how that plays out in the courts. But that's just the most recent example of sabotage. And that's not, or actually just taking data. More often than not, it can be just somebody, an employee with access he shouldn't have, accessing data that he shouldn't be able to get to. And it could be for fun, it could be for profit, or just curiosity.
Right.
For example, the healthcare industry is the industry that has the highest percentage of insider, not attacks, but a loss of data from insider access, simply because many times they're wanting to see patient data they shouldn't be able to see.
Right.
Doctors or nurses are curious looking at the patients they're not working with. And those are HIPAA violations for one thing, but many times they just have access to what they shouldn't have access to. And we even saw that there was one time with Wells Fargo, which is in the news, so we can talk about it. There was a lawsuit taking place and the law firm sent an e-discovery document to another law firm. And it turns out it had information on all the high profile customers for Wells Fargo for their investment banking unit. And it was, 50,000 customers had their data exposed all by accident because the e-discovery solution actually had more pages to it than the employee thought was associated. They only saw the first page, and by accident, they sent the whole thing. So it wasn't intentional, but yet the end result was the same, and you have 50,000 records that are out in the open.
All right. Well, I've seen unintentional as well. I saw a medical client where pictures were being taken on an iPad of a patient that were supposed to be then uploaded to their medical management platform. And then the iPad was just kind of left sitting somewhere. Now, luckily, it didn't get up and walk away.
Right.
But it certainly could have, because it was actually in an area where somebody could have simply reached over the counter, picked up the iPad and walked out and had a free iPad. And the reason I say free iPad was because guess what their PIN number was for opening up the the iPad?
Oh, no.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Well,
And yeah, so interesting enough. I wanted to go back and ask a question about the Tesla deal, because you were right. There's, depending on who you talk to, it's a matter of one camp saying it's employee sabotage, where another camp is saying, no, it's a whistleblowing situation.
Right.
But do we even know if this person was authorized to do what they're alleging that he did, in terms of, you know, having access not only to that information, but being able to, you know, siphon it off, I guess, to copy it and send it away?
Yeah, that's a good question. We don't know. And we don't know, you know, depending on who you talk to, you get a different story. And that's one of the biggest problems with companies today, public, private companies and cyber incidents, is there's no reporting mechanism in place. There's, companies don't have to share that they've had an incident necessarily, unless it affects a certain number of customers, or if it's particularly embarrassing, they may try to keep that information internal as long as possible. So many of the ransomware attacks that take place, or the data loss incidents that take place, we may never even hear about, because they're trying to keep that data private, and understandably. And so we may never really know what their real forensics team said, if they have a forensics team, or if they maybe they brought in somebody else in an outside firm to actually do forensics or try to see how bad the damage was. And then that's usually kept pretty confidential at that point. So unless it comes out in a court proceeding, many times you never know what actually happened.
I can tell you the techs that I work with that have had this issue, the forensics team is a nuke and pave team. It's really what that is. Oh, right. We found the offending workstation. Let's just wipe it and see that it never comes back again. Interesting. So with the tips that you mentioned earlier, I know that earlier this year, I think it was January, Fortalice actually put out a document entitled The State of Ransomware, or something to that effect.
Right.
So before I go over some of the tips that you mentioned in that document that also mirror the CIS, what is, because if that's January, we're here in August, much has changed in the landscape. What do you think the relationship or the state of ransomware is right now?
Ransomware is very prevalent. Again, another concern with ransomware is, depending on who you talk to, it's increased or decreased. But you know, the FBI says they had received fewer ransomware reports last year, but yet Verizon said that the number of attacks have actually doubled since last year. So it depends who you talk with, because not everybody that has a ransomware attack wants to talk about it, or they feel they can't go to anybody to talk about it. So reporting is kind of vague. And another reason ransomware is becoming more prevalent is, it's easy, first of all. It's very simple. Right. For you don't have to be an organized crime syndicate to actually launch a ransomware attack. You can just, you know, do it for less than $50. But the syndicates have a better grasp on things. But when they have actually lowered their price. It used to be, like, for, you know, we dealt with Mecklenburg County, and they had the ransom cost for them was, I think, about $24,000 per server to bring it back online. Wow. That's what they were told to pay for Mecklenburg. Now, they actually, there are several reasons why that did not take place that we can talk about. But the price typically was, last year, was about $1,000. The typical ransom demand is about $1,000. Now it's down to $500 because you know, these bad guys realize they can actually hit everybody out there, anybody from small business up to large size business. And for a small amount of money, if you lower the demand, you may get more people to pay it. So they can actually increase their profits that way. It's actually it's a business model for many, many people now. And even several years ago, there was a hospital where an advanced attacker went in the hospital and actually had done recon prior to actually sending the ransomware attack. And they actually knew the expense levels for all the different directors in the hospital. So when they did these ransomware attacks on different servers, they did it only for the amount that was just under the expense amount for that director. Oh. So all the director had to do was just pay it off the company card or company expense, and not even have to report it to upper management, because it was within their expense threshold. And they were able to make thousands and thousands off that one hospital just by targeting the directors. So they knew exactly who they were dealing with, but that took a lot of work ahead of time to do that. But
right now, are they still doing something? Remember, I mean, when CryptoLocker came out, and they, you know, that's when I guess it really came on the scene, where they had a sliding scale where, you know, if you paid within, say, the first 24 hours, it was this much. And then after the next 48 hours, it would jump and it would increase day by day. Are they still doing anything like that? I to be honest, I haven't seen one in a while. So,
well, it was interesting. They are doing that. But what we found is even more interesting is they'll do that initial ransomware attack. And even if you go and you back up your data and you bring everything back online, whether you paid the ransom or not, hopefully they didn't pay the ransom, but they bring the backup, depending on how far back that backup came from, there may be additional malware on there. And so the first phase is actually the ransomware attack. But then what they're doing is actually turning the servers into crypto mining servers. So even after they've been restored, they have crypto mining applications, malware running in the background, still making money for the bad guys indefinitely. It could go on for years if it's not detected. And we've actually seen that happen where not only do you have to look and do your forensics to make sure there's no more of the original malware on there, the ransomware malware, there's another level where you could have your servers actually running crypto mining applications in the background and not even know it. And that actually has been happening on more and more frequently now. So it's not just ransomware, it's the crypto mining aspect as well.
So it has gone much more beyond the botnet army. This is crypto mining army. And I guess the question would be then, is can you detect that in terms of through the firewall appliances? Can you identify that type of traffic? Or how is it that this stuff is going on and people don't know? I mean, if I want to go check my customers now, so.
Right. Well, yeah, you ideally you should, but how many companies actually have a SOC that's actually monitoring this? How many companies are actually checking their logs daily or frequently enough to actually detect this? Because we found even though ideally you should be checking your logs frequently, many companies aren't because they're overwhelmed or understaffed and they just don't have resources to actually be monitoring those logs and maybe see that traffic. So it's something we're seeing more and more of because honestly, it works and it's another revenue stream for the bad guys.
I'm kind of sorry I asked that question now. Oh, wow. So let me go back to the article. So the article also gave tips as to what companies should do. And a lot of them you actually mentioned earlier when you talked about the Center for Internet Control. But one of the things that wasn't in that tip, which was the very first tip in the Fortalice document, is backup.
Right. Backup, but there's even more to it than that. Not just backing it up. What you don't want to have is a backup that's online or even another directory with your original files. Well, what attackers will also do is, ideally, if they're smart with what they're doing, they will have already been in your network and been reconning the network, and they will try to get your backups as well. So theoretically, they want to do is get your backups and also modify your backups. So if it's not an air-gapped backup or a backup that's actually kept offline at another facility, somewhere absolutely separate, then you're just backing up your systems with a backup that's been compromised as well.
Right.
Or if you're using one of the most recent backups, let's say, it may have already been compromised and you don't know that. So you're going to say yesterday's backup, but they actually got into the system 2 months ago. Extreme case here, but you could be putting in just another variation that's already been compromised. So that's why we also advise with doing that forensics research, not just blindly just trying to reset all your servers and bring them back online. You want them back online as quickly as possible, but what you don't want is to be back online and still have that malware running in the background and just assume that you're good to go when you really aren't. And then you fall prey to another ransomware attack maybe next week because they still have their same command and control servers back up and they're still in your network.
So is there a difference now in the way that you can detect ransomware? I know that the most common way is that either the network monitoring system will identify changed files so that if files are showing up being renamed and encrypted, for instance, I've got a backup program that, we've got a backup that goes every hour. And as part of that backup, it's going to check those files. Or a user goes to open a file and, hey, it doesn't open anymore. And why does it look funny?
Right.
So, I mean, are they changing the way that ransomware is happening so that those files aren't being encrypted? Because if you're saying that it can run for days before anybody notices it, that's a long time.
It is a long time. And, the ways are constantly changing. Even when I was in the Navy, we had this constant back and forth battle between the radar systems and, you had radars and you had the countermeasure systems, trying to evade radars. And so every time you improve your radar, they try to come up with another system that would defeat your radar. And it's the same thing in the cyber world as well, especially as we're looking at bringing on AI for both the offensive side and the defensive side. There's an arms race in the cyber world as well. And in the even with ransomware, we're trying to actually, you know, one side's trying to prevent it, come up with better tools, and the other side's trying to learn from that and thwart that. So it's a constant battle.
All right. So going back to the list of tips, so we talked about the backup. Number two, don't pay the ransom. We all should know that. But number three, there's an item called Contact No More Ransom. Can you describe that for us?
Sure. That's a resource where many times the ransomware is something that's been seen before. And there are resources out there that actually may already have the key to unlock your servers. So there may be a key with the resource you mentioned. Sometimes the FBI has it as well. And if it hasn't been updated yet, and if the bad guys haven't figured out, you know, to change it yet or modify it, somebody may already have that key. So as communication improves, and hopefully as companies talk more and more with each other, with these resources, and we recommend going to FBI as well, to see that they may already have the key and may save a lot of headache for everybody if they can provide you a key within that first 12, 24 hours and actually save the company a lot of money and a lot of headache as well.
Okay. So that's just a website that they can go to and look for decryption codes and stuff like that to help.
Right.
Okay. All right. And the rest of these all look pretty good, you know, in terms of train employees, be cautious, blah, blah, blah. And then I wanted to talk real quickly about the last tip where it says use a VPN. For my customers that do remote access back to a main office or even a user who wants to work at night, we've implemented VPN remote connections. And right. I've got some that are using a VPN client, some mm-hmm. that are using an SSL VPN. Mm-hmm. And I know that in the tech community, there's always this battle about which VPN is better and or whatever. But in your estimation, one, do VPNs work? And two, is there one better than the other or a type better than another?
To answer your first question, yes, VPNs do work. And we always recommend that over not using one. As far as which one to use, we're not seeing necessarily one that's better than the other. Just we like to see all our clients using them. And if we can just get to the point where people are using VPNs and not just going out over Wi-Fi and just connecting to whatever they can, or you know, airport free Wi-Fi and just getting access, which and a lot of people will. And you mentioned the law firm earlier with the principals that wanted what they wanted and when and yeah. Now
I want everything. Don't restrict me from anything.
That's right. And VPN's the same way. We've seen some clients where they don't want the hassle of VPN. They don't want to slow down. They think it's, you know, they just need to be able to do what they want now. And it goes back to that constant battle between confidentiality, integrity, and availability. You know, they want all their information now and want it to be the right information, and they want to be secure and available, but we want to keep it safe as well. And so trying to find that sweet spot between keeping the information confidential, but also being able to deliver it to them, to the stakeholders when they need it, is a battle we always face.
Right.
And so, yes, we push for VPN. Hopefully they understand over time. And again, we use more examples about, well, if you don't, you could be like example A over here, and we're trying to prevent that. Trying to educate them really helps, but there's always some stubborn ones out there.
Of course. One of the battles that I've started to be able to win for companies that will have a, you know, RDS or terminal server, mm-hmm. and they're used to going just straight to an external IP address through the internet, I've been able to, at least most of the time, show them that if you go through a VPN, it's actually faster mm-hmm. because you're not having to, I try to explain it as if to say that if, you know, you're on the open internet, you're having to battle all of the things on the internet between you and your office. Right. So it's like defensive tribing to the max on the internet. You know, when I, for down here, I tell them internet 95, mm-hmm. you know, think about every lane on 95 and every car is trying to hit you. Whereas if you get a secure VPN tunnel, that's just your road and you're not having a fight.
And that's a great analogy. And that brings up another great point about many times when we're dealing with these clients and they have no idea about technology. They just know they want to be able to get online and access their data now. But to be able to take a concept like that and put it in terms that anybody will understand, like the I-95 example is great. They'll understand that and they'll see that. And a lot of times the challenge is just getting the terms that we're wanting to convey, but speaking in a language that they'll understand and listen to. And that's a real talent to be able to take the technical side and translate that into user-friendly speak that an investment banker will understand and not get upset over.
Okay. All right. So I think we want to take a step away from ransomware. I want to go back to the things I was going to ask you about the shadow IT. Mm-hmm. And I know one of the great stories that Teresa told was how even in the White House, she had to deal with shadow IT, where she would do her walkabouts. And even if they were doing their wireless, you know, I forgot what she called it, walk driving or whatever, where they would just go around and see what's out there. You know, I've got some of my networks where I know what devices are on there and I know what access points I can find. I'll, you know, go with my network tester and I can plug it in and it'll tell me how many access points are for my network.
Right.
When she would talk about the fact that she would walk around and just find rogue wireless access points plugged in at the White House. that boggled me that, you know, you would think that that place would be secure, but that is seemingly becoming a bigger and bigger issue where customers are trying to do their own IT and, you know, they'll go to Office Depot or Best Buy and just buy something because the kid in the blue shirt told them to plug into the network and think that they're good to go. I want a wireless access. I don't want to bother IT. I don't want to pay for it or I don't want them to know. How much of an issue is something like that becoming?
It's a big issue and it's becoming more and more prevalent simply because, you know, if the equipment is out there. You can go to Office Depot or you know, Walmart and buy basically what you need or buy software off the shelf or devices off the shelf to help you do your job. And that's really the argument that employees will use. Like, well, we need this to do our job. If there is an approval process, well, the approval process is too difficult. We need this for sales right now. We need to be able to collaborate with others outside the company. We need this, you know, this chat application now, and we'll just install it. That's why we need admin privileges, and it just goes round and round. And yes, it goes back to that whole availability issue. They want to be able to do their job. If they don't see the reason why we need things secure, they'll just think it's just, you know, we're just being a pain in their neck and trying to, you know, keep them from doing their job.
Right.
And it really isn't the case at all. And so one thing we'll do these risk workshops where we actually go, and that happened with one investment firm we went to, and actually showed on screen, got everybody together and did a presentation and explained why it's a bad idea to be using your own devices. That yes, you know, IT wants to help you do your job, but the reason we're trying to keep you safe is so that you're not like the firm over here that got breached or here's the firm that had reputational damage and we're trying to keep your stock price up. We're trying to keep you guys secure. Here's why. And here's, you know, here's the damage that one rogue AP could cause. So multiply that by, you know, 50 across the footprint of the company there and you have a real problem.
So from a perspective of myself, who I'm not an employee of any of these companies, I'm the outside IT guy. I show up every now and then. So in terms of tips for people like me, because a lot of the listeners here, you know, most of them are not full-time at a company. They're just like me and they may have several clients. They may see them once a month or once a week or whatever. What types of tips do you think you could give for us in terms of walking into a customer on a regular basis and, you know, monitoring these types of, you know, rogue IT or BYOB, bring your own device, or BYOB.
that's a whole different issue at work, especially. If they're having BYOB issues, we have to have another talk with them. And that's a good point. You know, Teresa, you said that she mentioned war driving, and actually, and that's a concept where you actually can drive around a place and use a device like a pineapple made by Hack5, actually, you know, see what devices are out there, or use Kali, which is a Linux-based application, and you can see the points that are out there. It's difficult if you're showing up just once in a while on a place, other than visually seeing something, you know, unless you have time, resources, or being paid to do like a wireless audit which you can certainly do, you won't see those AP points other than just, you know, educating your customers over time, the clients, and trying to explain why, you know, the shadow IT is not a good thing. And what you want to get everything on the network. And for instance, if an exploit is announced, you know, some terrifying exploit is announced in the news or some vulnerability, if you don't even know what hardware you have, you may have some personally owned devices in the workplace that are affected by this new vulnerability, whatever it is. But yet, if you don't even know they're there, you can't control that. And then you could wind up sending company data out over the network that you never intended to. And which goes back to that foundational five, the cyber hygiene that I mentioned earlier, having that asset control and the hardware control and knowing what you have in place. But you have to get buy-in from the client as well and try to explain to them why you're doing what you're doing. And one phrase we use a lot is that nobody likes being told that their baby is ugly. And so part of our job is actually going there and as we're seeing things or issues with the network, we have to gently let these people know that, hey, it's a great baby, but it's ugly, but we can help make it look better, and here's how.
Hmm. I have to leave that comment alone. I have used that before. So you mentioned the access control. It's funny because in my head, I'm thinking I just had, well, it wasn't just, it was earlier this year, I had a very robust discussion with a customer that when we first set them up with their wireless access, they wanted to be as cheap as possible. And so we just set up a simple access point, one SSID just for them. And they weren't supposed to give out the password to clients and guests and patients, but they did. And I was the one that tried to convince them, okay, we need to set up a guest Wi-Fi. We need to VLAN. No, that's okay. Don't worry about it. We don't have anything. And it actually took another business walking into them and saying, hey, we can see all your server stuff. You probably should secure that. Mm-hmm. Then they were like, well, how can all of a sudden the questions abounded. And I said, I already had this discussion with you. Right. Do you not remember that? And so then it was like, oh, well, what do we need to do? And so then we finally did everything. And so we just finished phase three. And phase three was to actually put in access control list of all the wireless devices that were allowed to be on the corporate side of the network. Mm-hmm. And then everything else had to go on the guest side. And then we actually have, they actually have four SSIDs for them. So we had to VLAN all of them and get them all situated. So now they're showing up with devices that can't connect to the corporate network. And I'm like, well, you didn't submit that MAC address for me to put it on there. So, you know, they went through the frustration of having somebody else show them that they were not secure, going through this entire process of getting me set up. Now they're frustrated because, well, we don't want to have to do that every single time.
Well, again, it goes back to that whole CIA triangle. And that's a great way to do it. When you whitelist the devices that you want, and then everything else is almost like devices that no one will accept ownership of, you know, unplugging them or taking them off the network until they complain. And if no one complains, then you didn't really need a device on the network in the first place.
Right.
That's kind of the same methodology, but a great idea.
I've got another customer where it's funny. They again will give out their password to all their employees, but yet they don't want employees to waste the company bandwidth. So, I don't know, probably once a week or so, I'll go through. I've been given the authorization to where if I don't recognize the device, I can just simply block it. Mm-hmm. And it's funny because their frame of mind is, if you block the device and the person doesn't complain, then they shouldn't have been on there in the first place.
Right.
And I'm like, well, why don't you just give me a list of the ones that should be on there? Mm-hmm. Oh, we don't want to do that. I'm just like, okay, all right, then I'll just be blocking everybody. So that's fun. All right, so I think we've hit a couple of really good topics. Obviously, the ransomware, shadow IT. I have another question that we originally didn't think we'd talk about, but it's come up for me recently in the last couple of weeks. Mm-hmm. The dark web scanning, where, you know, I guess for the last, I don't even know if it's been a full year, where all of a sudden, everywhere you turn, somebody's offering to do a dark web scan. And now as a managed service provider, I'm getting companies calling me, hey, why don't you offer this service to your clients and stuff like that? So the battle of questions is, does it work? Is it legit? And should we be having our customers pay for us to monitor the dark web for them? What are your...
Sure. Well, the technology is there. You can scan for company data. The question is, do you want to spend the money to do it? Because it's not cheap. Obviously, you get what you pay for. But and different vendors have different takes on it. But the dark web itself, and, you know, I saw a presentation recently, and the gentleman showed pictures of not only, you know, drugs and weapons being sold and proprietary information that was redacted, that was online, but also Russian submarines. They were no longer in use. You can buy a Russian submarine if you want. So everything, he showed a picture of it. Everything in the world is on the dark web if you want to see it, including a Russian sub. But, and there are different vendors. It depends what kind of data you have. If it's, you know, there are some firms that have proprietary data that's leaked and sold on the dark web. For other firms, it's credit card information or personal identifiable information that can be used for identity theft. And so it depends. If your company has data that you really want to make sure is secure and not being leaked anywhere, and going a step past, you know, using Google Dorks to see, you know, for instance, if you have information out there, you can do it. And some firms are really good and really detailed. There are others that will give you minimal information, like maybe just employee passwords, things you can also find on Google if you look hard enough. So it's out there. It exists. The technology can be good. It depends how critical is your data. If you're running just a small family business, family pharmacy, you wouldn't really be interested in doing that. But if it's something where you actually have, if you're working with intellectual property that you want to make sure is not being marketed for sale out there, or not being marketed by an employee trying to make a quick buck before he leaves the company, then it can be useful.
All right. Sounds about in line with what I've heard, except for the fact that I had a discussion about how big is the dark web. And of course it was, well, there's the dark web and the deep web and the onion. And
that's right.
It's a lot bigger discussion than many of us are ready for. All right. Yeah. Were you getting ready to say something else?
No, that's exactly it. I've seen it described as like an iceberg, and you only see the tip of the iceberg above the water, and that's the normal internet traffic. And then everything underneath the iceberg, which can be much bigger underneath the water, that's where the deep web and dark web is. And people will argue always about what's down there when you dig deep enough and what you can find. But it's really not as scary as all the TV shows make you think.
Well, I can tell you this. The one thing that I don't like is the fact that they always show somebody in a hooded sweaty.
That's right.
As the dark web guy, when, to be honest, a lot of times it might be Joe sitting right next to you.
That's absolutely right.
So, all right. So, ladies and gentlemen, we've been talking with Jefferson Pike, Director of Risk and Compliance at FortiLife Solutions. I am going to try to get all of the things that we talked about, the links to the CIS. Let me see if I can get a copy of the ransomware update and stuff. Jefferson, do you have any other links that you may want to refer to us as where we can go for tips and recommendations?
Sure. For the Center for Internet Security, that's cisecurity.org. And another great resource is darkreading.com, which we use a lot, and you may already be using that as well. But it's a great resource to actually keep up to date on what's happening in the cyber world and with threats.
All right. I'll get those links in the show note for everybody. All right. Well, I want to thank you for making time. I know that you guys really have bigger fish that you go out and take care of, but it was nice to be able to get you guys to come on and do a show with me, get some information out to our listeners, and maybe have you guys back on again soon.
Absolutely. It was an honor to be here. Thank you very much.
All right. So, Jefferson, thank you. I also want to be sure I say thank you to Alyssa Smith, who is a Director of Marketing and Public Relations for FortiLife, who worked very hard to get this interview for me. So, all right, Jefferson, thank you again, and I wish you well. And ladies and gentlemen, we'll be back right after these messages to finish out the show. right, ladies and gentlemen, we are back. I want to give a special thank you to Jefferson Pike for that interview. Folks, you need to follow FortiLife Solutions. You need to find them on LinkedIn, find them on the Twitter. They are always providing tips, links to relevant stories, all about cybersecurity, all about regular security. FortiLife is a force in the industry that you need to pay attention to. So find them. I will put links in the show note. And just to let you know, folks, this is going to be an extra long show note because I am going to have not only all the links that we talked about in the interview with Jefferson, links to FortiLife. I'm going to put on links to some FortiLife documents that you should download and read. And I'm listing out the top 10 of tips of what you can use to protect against ransomware. If you want the actual PDF version of these tips direct from FortiLife, email me and I will send you that PDF. And I think I may have one or two other PDFs that can go along with it. I just probably should check and get permission first. But then we give some other web links that you may want to reference. Lots and lots of stuff to read about in terms of cybersecurity. So got those links there. And let's see. Good. Got all of the stuff. All right. So folks, that's going to do it for tonight. I do want to thank you for download and listening to this episode of PodNuts Pro. Please make sure that we are in whatever podcatcher that you have. Give us feedback. Email marvin@podnuts.com. And remember, that is PodNuts with a Z. PODNUTZ. I know that I don't spell that out enough for people, and sometimes you get lost. But marvin@podnuts.com. Email me questions, show suggestions, tips, whatever you want to hear, whatever you want me to talk about, whoever you want me to interview, and I will try to make that happen. So folks, that's going to do it for this episode of PodNuts Pro. Once again, a shout out to the victims of Hurricane Florence. If you can and are able to help, please do. They are going to need our help. And be listening for an upcoming podcast with NetScout. We've got a couple of special shows coming up. Folks, this is coming up to 100 episodes that I have recorded since the return of PodNuts Pro. We're going to have a couple of special shows dedicated to that. And then we're going to get right back into serious stuff with stories from the trenches, tips, all of that good stuff. So be looking forward to that. That's going to do it for tonight. And until next time, holla.